and the opioids, and then we will call it a morning. When we last met, we talked about the classic profile for sedatives, and we had catchphrases that I wanted you to remember and keep in mind as you're trying to solve some of these clinical cases, that if you see a list of symptoms and they're all pointing at suppression of function, breathing and heart rate and anxiety and consciousness and motor skills, and then I'm thinking probably sedative intoxication, so I'm thinking a benzobarb or alcohol. If I was withdrawing from a sedative, what would I be thinking about? I would be thinking about the opposite of suppression, but more and so more of an acceleration, and we describe that withdrawal syndrome as being more similar to an extreme panic reaction, and on top of the heart racing and nausea and insomnia and tremulousness that you very well may also experience, hallucinations. And it makes sense that sedatives would be in withdrawal form, be a potential cause of seizures, since in use form of sedatives are used to control seizures. So withdrawing from it would likely induce seizures. We ended yesterday talking about stimulants like meth and coke and amphetamine, that being intoxicated on these kind of drugs would mimic what a bipolar patient might look like, sort of euphoric or agitated, with pressured speech and flight of ideas, and potentially even hallucinations and delusions. So I think bipolar 1 with or without psychosis. Withdrawal, what is that like? Well, that's where we're picking up now. If in intoxication form, stimulants cause this grandiosity, this manic-like state, what's the opposite of mania? Depression, right? Depression. And that's absolutely what is seen. Depression. And if you heard about depression with overeating, oversleeping, what kind of depression would we have classified the person as if they had MDD? Atypical. So when you think about the profile for someone withdrawing from a stimulant, I think MDD with atypical features. And if I'm not hearing that type of symptomatology, then probably not the right drug profile. As much as being intoxicated on a stimulant can be life-threatening because of the cardiovascular changes, withdrawing from a stimulant, withdrawing from cocaine or methamphetamine, although you can feel very depressed and overeat and oversleep, it usually isn't something that's going to lead to death. So it's, relatively speaking, not one of our major concerns about mortality is withdrawing. Withdrawing from sedatives, withdrawing from alcohol, withdrawing from benzos would be much more problematic life-wise. As far as how would we treat someone who's a meth addict or a cocaine addict, we have cognitive behavioral therapy, support groups, so forth. Do we have any specific FDA-approved meds that we can use as an adjunct? We don't have anything specific. You might still try something, but there's no approved med for someone who is an addict to a major stimulant. Now, just a couple of other stimulants I wanted to highlight because they're getting a lot of press and there's a lot of publicity about them. Ecstasy, MDMA, also known as Molly. This is a drug that is classified as a stimulant, but it has additional perceptual altering properties. So it is considered a mix of a hallucinogen with a stimulant. And this drug is quite popular because it's used to help you stay up and sort of party all night. In addition to give you that stimulant energy and insomnia and appetite suppression and those and feeling good as stimulants would normally cause, it also causes sights and sounds to look more interesting and more intense, and hence that perceptual altering property. And these drugs are known as the hug drug, the feel-good drug, the club drug, because it tends to make people a little bit more sociable, a little bit more gregarious, a little bit more, oh, come on in, join me, yes, I love you type of thing. Versus alcohol tends to do what to some people? They get some more belligerent and aggressive potentially, whereas the MDMA drug is thought to promote more socialness, and they call it this empathogenesis, where you just start, oh, don't stand over there by yourself. Come, join us. Don't be. So there's the reputation of this drug is that it's very safe. And the argument is it's safer than alcohol can be. At the same time, it's there's evidence to suggest that it's still hurting neurons in the brain, dopaminergic, serotonergic in particular. In some cases, depending on how much you use, you can have thermoregulatory problems, and if you have a high temperature, you're going to blow out other organs. And despite whatever people's opinions are about this drug being safer, relatively speaking, than other drugs, it is still Schedule 1, totally illegal, no medicinal value. And as I say, no medicinal value, guess what they're doing studies on right now to help people with post-traumatic stress? Ecstasy-enhanced psychotherapy. Come talk to me for 45 minutes while you're on MDMA. And we'll talk about your trauma and the horrible experience you had. And again, it's just experimental, but the small number of subjects that have participated have said that, you know, I've gone through so many psychotherapies in my life and nothing has helped me like ecstasy-enhanced psychotherapy. Because in that therapeutic relationship now, you really believe that someone's listening to you. You really feel safe and you're able to talk about it, relive it, process it in this safe context. Safer than what ordinarily you would experience, safer because of this drug-induced state. So we'll see if it ultimately does get approved for certain clinical uses, but right now, still Schedule 1, no medicinal value. Other one I wanted to mention, and this was one where I heard, oh, people abusing bath salts, and I thought, what are people doing with their little baubles and fragrant beads for their showers? So I totally ignored it, thinking, well, that's no different than sniffing gasoline, so I just kind of, whatever. Until Miami headlines. Man high on bath salts eats face off of homeless man. And then I thought, now I became very interested in what bath salts were all about. And when I followed that case, they ultimately said that the guy was high on marijuana. Marijuana does not cause you to eat someone's face. So the problem with bath salts is that they're designer, they're synthetic, and you might not be able to detect it with our conventional drug tests. But the common ingredient for these synthetic drugs are that they have very stimulant-like properties to them. So if you wondered what it's like to be high on bath salts, you are on meth, cocaine, that type of experience where you're going to be revved up, probably very, if anything, manic with the psychotic features. Okay? But with very, I've read cases where they say that heart rate was 170. I didn't even know you could live with 170 heart rate. I mean, this is one that's really pumping up your cardiovascular system, let alone what it's doing to your mood. So just recall, very agitated, very manic, likely with psychotic features experience if you're high on bath salts. Okay, what symptoms do we have to explain? We have the paranoid agitation, we have delusional mydriasis, so enlarged pupils, the heart rate, hypertension. What does this sound like? Try to take all those symptoms and give me an expression, a theme. Yeah, this sounds more like a manic patient who's psychotic. And if you can encapsulate all those symptoms into one phrase and then relate it to something we've talked about, probably amphetamine intoxication is the best choice. It's a stimulant intoxication. MDMA intoxication, that is a stimulant, but what did we just say about ecstasy? It's going to make you just love people. So chances are you're not going to become this. You could, but it would usually you're more... again, empathic and sociable and gregarious, so that doesn't quite fit. Okay. And benzo withdrawal, why wouldn't that fit? Benzo withdrawal, you're looking for an extreme anxiety reaction. Do we have extreme anxiety reaction? Kind of, but what would the eyes be dilated? I think the dilation of the eyes would lean you more towards stimulant intoxication. So those were the major stimulants. Minor stimulants, keep in mind that caffeine and nicotine are stimulant drugs. They're going to have similar properties, not as powerful, but still stimulant-like. So they will have the properties of helping you sustain attention and making you feel better and suppressing appetite, just like our major stimulants. As far as nicotine goes, as much as you could possibly get sick on nicotine, if you smoke, you might throw up, but there is no recognized intoxication pattern. Can you have a withdrawal syndrome if you were addicted and used it heavily and stopped? Absolutely. And typically it's a very uncomfortable, sort of dysthymic mood, kind of irritable and unsettled. And a huge factor in why you return to using nicotine, which symptom do you think is actually the one that gets a lot of people disgusted and they go back to smoking? It's the weight gain. It's the increased appetite that happens and they end up gaining weight and they get upset and then they go back to smoking. As far as FDA-approved treatments for nicotine addiction, you've already covered under your behavioral medicine very thoroughly, so I'm not going to repeat that, but just remember there are officially approved drugs to help someone who is got nicotine use disorder. Caffeine. I mentioned yesterday that you can actually be intoxicated on caffeine. How much would it take for you to get that way? Well, DSM says it should be well over 250 milligrams worth of caffeine. But remember, DSM doesn't care really about how much milligrams you take. What is the importance? The change, the behavioral change, the physical change. But they said usually to get the physical, emotional, psychological change, you got to drink well over 250. Well, what does that correspond to? How much is in a classic can of Coke? 40 maybe milligrams, maybe 50 in Mountain Dew. So this is drinking a number of drinks back to back. And then what do you experience? Well, you experience stimulant, that kind of manic-like feeling where you've got all these brilliant ideas and you're talking away and you're multitasking and you're talking faster and pressured speech. But it's not as bad as cocaine or meth, but it's still manic-like. So what we call it? Hypomanic. I think it is definitely one that can induce a hypomanic-like state. So that's what I think about. This is just someone who's not quite manic, but they are definitely accelerated based on the drug they're on. DSM-5 just recognized that there's a withdrawal syndrome. They had to debate this for a long time, but if you use caffeine and caffeine a lot, and you stop, are you going to have a headache? Yeah. Are you going to feel blah and, feeling sluggish? And yes, you will likely. And it's recognized that you can experience the opposite of hypomania. And the opposite of hypomania, I say, is dysthymia. It's just that if you want to think about a way to think, you feel blah, sleepy, lethargic, can't really pay attention very well. Opposite of hypomanic. When you think about, I mentioned this that at the beginning when I talk about the DSM diagnoses, that you can have caffeine intoxication, you can have caffeine withdrawal, but there's some disorders, for example, where you can't have addiction. And this is one where DSM says, if you went through the checklist of the 11 symptoms of being a use disorder, that you cannot meet criteria for caffeine use disorder. Well, why not? Can you become tolerant to it? Yes. Can you have withdrawal? Yes. Can I give up important activities because I want to use caffeine? I do. I don't want to work out. I'd rather drink my caffeine right now. Or can it cause relationship problems? Yes, I've proven it. So, I mean, I can definitely check more than two, but DSM says, well, it's just, you might check a whole bunch, but it's just not substantial enough to say that you have a use disorder. they're considering it for the future, but right now you can't diagnose addiction to caffeine. If you are seeing patients who all of a sudden are saying, I've got insomnia or I've got this anxiety, and you have to consider the role of drugs in their experience, because sometimes you don't have insomnia due to classical conditioning or any other effects. You have insomnia because you're drinking too much caffeine. So, or you're feeling anxious around exams. Are you developing an exam social phobia? Or is it that because it's exam time, you're consuming way too much caffeine and you're getting jittery from the caffeine, and it has nothing to do with exams? And then you do have to consider the interaction of caffeine and alcohol. And Four Loko is kind of banned in several states because it is a large drink that contains basically 4 or 5 beers worth of alcohol plus a couple of Red Bulls mixed together in a fruity tooty carbonated beverage. And all it means is you drink one of these and say, hey, I've had one drink, because it's fruity tooty and carbonated. And because of the caffeinated content, what are you thinking about? You're thinking, I don't even have a buzz really. I can drink more. I don't feel that drunk. And so you drink and you drink and you drink to excess, because the mixture of caffeine with the sedative is giving you the impression that you're actually sober when you're not. And what this has resulted in is a few people, college students, winding up in the emergency department, basically with blood alcohol levels that are toxic, because they've just kept drinking. And so you do have to worry about that combination. The hallucinogens and related drugs. These are technically 3 separate categories of drugs, but we're talking about them because they do together, because they all share in common some sort of perceptual alteration. And the perceptual alteration is a slightly different, bless you, depending on the one you're talking about. With the hallucinogens, like what the synthetic LSD or mescaline, which is from cactus, and psilocybin, which is from mushrooms, you're likely going to frankly hallucinate. You're going to have sensory perception, and there's just no stimulus there, and you're still perceiving something. Your cannabis, which likely you don't hallucinate. You can, but it's usually that you just have alterations or intensifications of a stimulus perception. There is a stimulus there. You're perceiving it, but the perception is somehow altered. And then the dissociative anesthetics like ketamine and PCP are ones that make you feel outside yourself. They're supposed to be an anesthetic. Why are they anesthetic-like? You're still conscious, but you don't really care because your body's over there and your mind is kind of elsewhere. You feel depersonalized. You feel outside of yourself. So the perceptual altering abilities are slightly different. And then depending on how much you take, you could blur the lines here, but trying to keep them fairly distinct. So these drugs, if you use them in general, are supposed to be peaceful and calming, despite the fact that mentally you might feel calm, but you still have perhaps accelerated heart rate, you might have some mydriasis, so you might still have some enlarged pupils, so you still have some sympathetic nervous system arousal, but in the context of your brain feeling, or your mind feeling more calm. Now, if you start, as you're experiencing these perceptual changes, and you start having paranoid thoughts, and then all of a sudden you can turn this this presumably peaceful experience into something quite agitated and scary, depending on where your thoughts may take you. There are concerns that if you're taking these drugs to perceive things differently, to have a perceptual alteration, that it's permanent. And there's some evidence definitely coming out of Amsterdam that suggested there's a connection between early marijuana use and ultimately developing schizophrenia. But we discussed how chances are that if you are using marijuana and you do ultimately develop schizophrenia, was it marijuana totally at fault? Probably you were genetically susceptible to schizophrenia to begin with. There's a lot of people that smoke marijuana and not that many schizophrenics, comparatively speaking. So let's talk first of all about the classic hallucinogens, LSD, and there's so many designer hallucinogens now, but it's very powerful, not necessarily the most, but it is definitely one of the most, and it's long lasting. And the major symptom of LSD is visual hallucinations. If visual hallucinations aren't part of the package, it's not LSD. And the hallucinations they experience aren't necessarily elaborate. Like in a schizophrenic, you would see a they would be talking to a person. There's a person there. There's many people there, and they're talking to them. They're well-formed people. The visual hallucinations in LSD are more shapes and colors, kaleidoscope, not so elaborate. And to give you an idea, this is, I'll tell you about what this woman experienced. This was back in the 60s, and scientists thought, wouldn't it be interesting to call in housewives and put them on LSD and see what they experience? So this woman was put on LSD, and she's very calm, again, peaceful, calm, and she's saying, "It's here. Can't you feel it? This whole room, everything is in color, and I can feel the air. I can feel the air. I can see the molecules. I'm part of it. Can't you see it? It's just like you're released or you're free." "How do you feel inside?" the experimenter asks. "Inside? I don't have an inside." And then the experimenter says, "Is it all one?" "It would be all one if you weren't here and if nobody else were. Yes, everything is one. You have nothing to do with it. I am one with what I am. I can see everything in color. You have to see the air. You can't believe it. And the dimensions and the prisms and the rays and everything coming down through you and moving. What does this all mean to you?" "I've never seen such infinite beauty in my life. It's like a curtain. A spider web. Can you see it? It's right here in front of me, right here, right now. No, good heavens, you know it went right through me. It passed right through me. Me. There wasn't even me." Now, what does that, can you imagine experiencing, "I'm not one, I'm one, I'm one"? That is weird. That is a perceptual alteration. And what she's seeing, spider webs and colors and prisms, that's classic. You know, she's not seeing whole people. She's seeing shapes and if you use these type of drugs and then withdraw or stop using them, there's no, DSM doesn't recognize any particular set of symptoms that you would experience. So for this, for the exam, there's just no recognized classic pattern of withdrawal. What they can experience, though, is what they call HPPD. And this is exactly what it says. There's a persisting perceptual distortion. And I just read a case even this morning that said for the past 20 years since using LSD, he took 15 hits of acid when he was younger, 20 years later, he still has some weird perceptual distortions going on. If a vehicle goes by, he sees it gets elongated. He's looking at words in a book, and the words start just kind of moving around. Why is there a halo around your head? Why did your shirt turn from dark blue to pink to light blue? And this is just going on and on. And I haven't heard an excellent explanation for this, but other than there is some change that's gone on that keeps your perceptual skills a little bit altered. So if someone experiences it, they think, if this is happening and you haven't done drugs forever, you're thinking, am I stroking? What is wrong with me? And they go to neurologists, and you have to recognize that this might be what they're experiencing. So HPPD. Cannabis. Now, we used to always think about, well, after you start using alcohol and before you start using meth and coke, that there's this transition drug, and it was marijuana. But now it's not. Now it's Percocet. Now it's some opiate that you're painkiller that someone in your family has had prescribed to them. So it's not necessarily the gateway anymore. If you smoke marijuana, less likely that it's going to last so, the high will last so long, and less likely you're going to become psychotic, have any sort of hallucinations or delusions. If you ingest it, though, the drug gets metabolized a little bit differently, and you've got something that's more likely to last longer and that could cause definitely psychotic features. But in general, you don't think about cannabis as causing hallucinations. There is an association, and again, cause and effect unknown, that someone who is a regular cannabis user may not be the one going to work or going to class or being a productive member of society. So they talk about this lack of activity as being a motivational syndrome. What's it like to be intoxicated on cannabis? Again, it's not, again, hallucinations. But there is a perception. There was a taste. There was a sound. There was a sight. It was there. But it's more rich. It's more intense. It's amplified. So the perceptual distortions are common. As an example, this is not an experience from college, but a friend of college. And she was eating potato chips. And of course, you've got the amplification of sense, so of taste. So she's, oh, the salt. It was like basic raving how incredible this potato chip. It's not potato chips. They're always good. But this on marijuana was particularly good. So she's raving about, oh my goodness, how great it was. And then the edges are so sharp. These are dangerous. Has anyone ever thought about using this as a weapon, potato chips? No, you'd never have that thought. You're like, oh, yum, these are great. But just this notice that it's sharp and it can be dangerous, and you have this, you think it's a brilliant epiphany, and then the next morning, you're like, well, come on. Potato chips as weapons probably is not going to work. So perceptual distortions. On top of that, you do tend to have, so this is my little saying. You're supposed to feel mellow on cannabis, but another characteristic is that people laugh at things that just aren't even remotely funny. So again, they're perceiving things in a different way, processing it in a different way, ascribing meaning to it in a different way, and they tend to get a little giddy. So silly but mellow. And physically, you do tend to see the irritation of the conjunctival vessels, so the red eyes. The whole idea is, do you really get the munchies, or is that just an excuse to eat? Apparently, it is an appetite stimulant, so that is true. And that they are one, that the drug would cause dry mouth, so they would be usually drinking a lot of fluids, whatever that fluid may be. DSM-5 just recognized cannabis withdrawal. They didn't think there was a predictable syndrome, but now they're acknowledging it. And if you think about being intoxicated on cannabis as being mellow but silly, this is stressed out. I guess you could think agitated. If you were stressed out, okay, yeah, if I'm stressed, I do definitely get more irritable, and I'm probably a little on edge. I'm probably, my mood's a little down. I'm not going to sleep. Okay, and I probably won't eat if I'm stressed. So I think stressed out. Now, if you were, and if you look at the physical symptoms, I think about someone who's stressed out, but then I'm just trying to come up with an easy way to remember these cluster of symptoms, but stressed out with food poisoning, okay. Not feeling well, sweating, crampy, shaky. So there is a recognized cannabis withdrawal syndrome. It's not life-threatening. It's not comfortable, though, but recognizing it could exist. Already mentioned legally Schedule I drug. No medicinal value, but states have done their own thing. So at the state level, it may be legal. And then the dissociative anesthetics. Drugs that, again, are supposed to make you feel peaceful, calm, but in intoxication form, you're looking at a very volatile situation. So these, if you think about, if you YouTubed PCP intoxication, likely you're going to see a picture of someone naked directing traffic. That is very classic. And they're not making sense, and they're just talking, ranting, raving. And then chances are police will get called, and then there'll be an assault because the person's kind of out of control. People that are driving are likely yelling at the person to get out of the way and honking the horn, and the concern is that they are very sensitive to sound, so hyperacusis. So the more you honk and the more you yell at them, the more they're going to get agitated and out of control. This is a screenshot of a case where he had gone into a restaurant and, again, ranting, raving, and had stripped naked, went over to a patron's table, grabbed their glass of water, took an ice cube, stuck it up their rectum, took the glass, threw it at a police get called, and they couldn't control them. What do you do when you can't control a person that out of control nowadays? They stun gun them, and they stun gun them, and they stun gun them. And now they had stun gunned him and then, or, you know, tasered him and then made sure that he wasn't spitting and biting and everything else. So they put that wrap around his head. And this gives you an idea of the text that he was saying. Granny's Jeezy Easy, clean up my mama's whores tomorrow, Chinese with gods or devils with Jesus. That's the ranting coming out of their mouth. So PCP intoxication is really considered a psychiatric emergency. They're out of control. You don't know what they're going to do. So my catchphrase for PCP, and this was someone who was alternating. They would taser him, and he would keep coming at you and taser him. So they were macing, taser, mace, taser, mace, taser. And that gets at one of these other major symptoms is that they don't respond to pain. That they can have injuries, they can have notable injuries, like that should hurt, and they're not even complaining about it. They're still coming at you. So what you see is a lot of out-of-control behaviors, but some neurological symptoms, and that is nystagmus being one of the major ones where their eyes would show the involuntary bouncing around horizontally or vertically. So looking at their eyes could maybe help you tell if it was PCP or not. But you can see in other neurological symptoms like the muscle rigidity. So when I think about PCP intoxication, I think someone who's just extremely unpredictable, volatile, but you've got to see some neurological symptoms as well, like the uncoordinated gait or the lack of responsiveness to pain or the nystagmus. What do you do with someone? Well, as you saw, people were tasering and macing and tasering and macing. Maybe an injectable antipsychotic could help calm them down. One thing to keep in mind is having a whole bunch of people scream, scream, scream at the person high on PCP is not helping because, again, their sensitivity to sound will probably increase their agitation. So it is basically got to get them calmed down and time until the drug metabolizes and they're not in that acute state anymore. The dissociative anesthetics, another class of drugs where even if you use ketamine a lot or PCP a lot, no predictable recognized withdrawal symptoms. So this is just your summary chart, hoping to help you, even though perceptual alterations are the commonality for all these kinds of drugs, this helps try to classify them based on certain behaviors and physical symptoms. Okay, so what do you think of this person? Okay, most of you recognize that this looks like a withdrawal state. It doesn't look like likely high on anything if you're nervous and, well, let's see. What is this trying to get at? What is a common drug used in college? Marijuana would lean you toward just that general age range and thing you would do. And then she moves off campus and she gets busy, which is suggesting that what? She's not maybe having time to engage in her drug habit. And then she's likely experiencing withdrawal after not having used the drugs for a few days, and she's in this kind of dysphoric, nervous, irritable state and not hungry. So this is just more compatible with the marijuana withdrawal syndrome. Why not marijuana intoxication? What's the first thing you would think? You'd eat too much. You definitely want to eat more, not eat less. All right, the last class are narcotics, are opioid painkillers. And there's a whole host of them that you'll hear about, whether it's your OxyContin and your Percocet and your Vicodin. And these are drugs that are medically used because they help kill pain. But as a, an additional effect. It's they're just not painkillers. They're ones that actually do produce a euphoria. And as much as they might be good painkillers, the problem is that because of the euphoria, you tend to become addicted to them. Certain drugs may be better painkillers with less euphoric properties. Some are more euphoric, like heroin, for example, extremely euphoric producing. It might not be the best painkiller, but it's extremely euphoric producing, so very addictive. Now, keep in mind, when you think about someone with heroin addiction, people think, oh, you must have track marks because you always inject. You don't have to inject, so you could find a heroin user who actually doesn't have the telltale track marks because they're using it another way, whether they're smoking it or snorting it. And conversely, you could have someone who has a ton of track marks and they're not using heroin at all. They're just shooting up their amphetamines or shooting up some other drug. So needle marks aren't always going to help you tell which drug they're using. But classically, they are used with, you'll have them in heroin use. What is the high like with these drugs? When you inject, usually it is injection, that you're going to get this very intense, they call it a flash or a rush. And the rush is akin to, it's been described as orgasm, but better than orgasm, affecting every cell of your body. And after that flash you get, then you become very sleepy, sort of in what they call you have the nods, you start to fade off. But you end up in this state, what they would say, the blissful nods. You're just in this sedate, euphoric state. Now, you can have euphoria as part of meth. You can have euphoria as part of many drugs. But in this case, you've got euphoria with that sedation. Whereas with meth and coke, you're going to have euphoria, but you're going to be running around very motorically active. Drug wears off fairly quickly, and then with very soon, and some people say they can't even go an hour or even two without having that blissful experience diminish, and then they want to get that experience, that sensation back so that they need to use again. So blissful nods, eye-wise, pinpoint pupils is classic, so you're going to see very reduced size, far as millimeters go, size of pupils. If they were overdosed, classically, they're going to be unresponsive. So they'll be unconscious, unresponsive, very little breathing. If they have breathing, they'll be four breaths in a minute, and it'll be very shallow. And the thing is, some people, when they find someone who's sort of unconscious, not breathing much, they think, oh, they're just drunk. Let them sleep it off. Well, that probably isn't the greatest solution for someone who is overdosed on opioid because they're likely going to die. So when you find someone who is very intoxicated or overdosed on a drug like heroin, then there is a magic antidote. And that is a very short-acting, fast-acting drug called naloxone, or Narcan is the trade name. We've talked about naltrexone. Naltrexone's an opioid receptor blocker too, but that's long-lasting and slow-acting. This one's got to act quickly to reverse the effects of the heroin. It's got to displace the heroin and occupy the receptor so that heroin no longer has an effect. So Narcan, and what they're even putting sometimes in first aid kits around college campuses or handing them out to relatives in areas where they know there's a lot of heroin users, because usually heroin overdoses don't happen in isolation. There's someone with them, and someone there could save the life. Unfortunately, what is the mentality if you're in this heroin-using area, that alleyway, and you see someone overdosed, are they thinking, hey, I can save them, or what are they thinking? If they die, more heroin for me. It's often very cutthroat, and they'll admit it's cutthroat. They die, it's more stash. They're not necessary. And then the people who are resuscitated from the Narcan, it's a nasal injection or an injection, they're often mad. Why did you do that? You took away my high. I saved your life. No, you took away my high. And then what do? They go and get some more stash. So it's a frustrating experience because this drug is so powerfully reinforcing. Okay, so nasal spray or injection, fast-acting, reverse the effects. You've already heard from Dr. Mandalanini about withdrawal being just like a bad, bad case of the flu. Note that means it's not likely life-threatening versus intoxication, which is very life-threatening. Okay, so flu-like. Treatment, two major approaches. We can expect abstinence, or we can expect to give you a substitute. Abstinence-based therapy says you are off the drug, you're detoxed. We're going to give you naltrexone, the long-lasting opioid receptor blocker. And we're just going to expect that you don't use. And then if you do use, you relapse, that you won't get as much high from your drug. Doesn't tend to work because people just don't take their naltrexone. They just stop taking it after a couple of days or however long. So we're having a hard time keeping them on this antagonist therapy. So what's the, at least what the U.S. and Canada does is offer replacement therapy. That is, we're going to give you a drug that is safer than heroin, but it's still going to give you some opioid rush, but just not as addictive. So we have two choices: methadone, buprenorphine. Not surprisingly, it's more effective. We're not expecting you to be abstinent. We're just giving you something that actually gives you some degree of pleasure. The rationale, and remember, some countries don't even allow this. They said you cannot give an addict morphine or methadone. You can't give them a drug that just replaces their vice. They just don't even allow it. So some countries, abstinence therapy, that naltrexone is your only choice. North America, we have the option to give addicts replacement therapy. We think that because of the anhedonia that they experience during that protracted abstinence, the fact that physically their body may not be producing as much of the natural opioids just for general comfort's sake, that when they aren't on the drug, they've got that gray cloud, and physically they just hurt. They bump into something, they hurt, they just ache. They just feel so uncomfortable even after their detox that they just will find it very difficult to stay clean. So we think, let's give them a replacement drug. So harm reduction is the motto. And methadone, schedule 2, so you see that it is medically prescribable, but still considered addictive and dangerous. If you were going to prescribe methadone for pain, for a pain patient, if you had the special registration to prescribe a controlled substance, no problem. Not so if they're an addict. If you want to give someone methadone because they're an addict, you can't prescribe it. You aren't allowed to. What you can do is make sure that that addict gets enrolled in a treatment program, and they can come once a day to the treatment program and take their dose. But it's not prescribable to an addict. So special rules when it comes to using these drugs if you're an addict. What this means is that you don't reach as many addicts, because how many people want to come and get registered and come every day to get their methadone? They could just go use their heroin. So we're missing a lot of addicts because of the more limited circumstances in which you can get this replacement therapy. The alternative is buprenorphine, less scheduled. So we're saying, well, it's still risky, still addictive, but schedule 3. So not as bad as methadone. For addiction treatment, this is one that the physician would have to get extra, they'd have to do a little bit of training and certification, and then they could, even for an addict, prescribe buprenorphine. They can only have so many patients that they do this for, there's some restrictions, but they actually can prescribe it, which means an addict can get a 30-day or however many day prescription, and more likely than they're going to get treated, versus the person who has to physically go to a center, a specialized center, and pick it up every day. So it can be. So it reaches more addicts. Now, just so you know, Suboxone is a drug that does contain buprenorphine. And remember I said that naloxone is not used for addiction treatment. Naloxone is the antidote for overdose. Why does Suboxone have naloxone in it? It's a deterrent of abusing it, because if you take your drug appropriately, if you take Suboxone appropriately, swallow it, no problem, naloxone never gets released. But if you try to crush it up so that you can now somehow inject it or snort it, then naloxone gets released. And what happens if naloxone's released? It blocks the effect of the buprenorphine. So it's just an anti-abuse mechanism. It does nothing as far as helping addiction. It just stops you from abusing your Suboxone. The goal ultimately is not to keep you on methadone or buprenorphine your whole life, but that might be the way it happens. If you are wanting to taper them off, maybe it's only after a few months, but oftentimes it is at least a few years that you're on these drugs. And despite the fact we are giving them their vice, we are giving you a drug of abuse, but we're doing so in a way that keeps this person alert. They're not just sleepy and in this blissful euphoric state, but they are productive. They can hold jobs. They're not getting this great high because they're not getting the big spike, but just this constant level of feeling okay. And that allows them to be functional. So the data suggests it actually is a useful approach to deal with opioid addiction. What I wanted to do is let you know about what happened. I followed up on Aubrey. I told you she had been in and out of rehab so many times. Well, even after this documentary aired, well, apparently she went on naltrexone patch to keep her off the heroin, and the patch lasts, I think, for 30 days. So, okay, better, because it's 30 days, you can't do much if it's... Then she went off of it and said, no, I'm just going to take the pill. Well, the pill requires more frequent administration, and then she just went back to heroin use. So again, you hear more relapse. Then she got pregnant and then said, okay, I'll do replacement therapy. So she's on methadone. Then she gets arrested because she stole from her mother's friend so she could buy more heroin, and ultimately went into an inpatient setting because she was getting close to needing to give birth. So she had a child, and then kind of lost track of her. So then I was Facebooking. I was looking at criminal records. I was trying to find out, where is she in 2017? And I think I found her on Facebook. And from what I can tell, she's got two children now and very heavily into church, and it sounds like a good support system, and she's clean and sober. That is my happy ending to the story of Aubrey. Okay, I've got your summary chart. What do you think of all the drugs? If you actually, there was a survey done by experts in Europe about what is ultimately the most harmful drug, looking at health costs, societal costs, criminal costs, everything like that. Yeah, can you believe it? It was alcohol. I mean, it is the drug that's not scheduled. It's our non-scheduled drug. Okay. So it's very odd that alcohol, being a non-regulated drug. All right, let's do a closing MCQ. Okay, let me go through this. Very good. Most of you got it. Cocaine withdrawal. What would we be? Okay, first of all, cocaine withdrawal. What would we look at? I'm getting too excited. There's my hypomania. Okay. If we look for cocaine withdrawal, what is the theme we'd be looking for? MDD with atypical features. Are we hearing anything about depression and eating too much and sleeping too much? No. So cocaine withdrawal is not great, because we would want MDD with atypical features. PCP intoxication. Out of control with neurological symptoms. Don't really have that as the dominant theme here. Heroin intoxication. Blissful nods. Right? Euphoria with blissful nods. This is not someone who is in the blissful nods state. Cannabis withdrawal. Stressed out. Not really fit and stressed out. You usually don't have formication, which is the hallucination, the somatosensory hallucination. Benzo withdrawal. panic attack, sort of extreme anxiety reaction with the possibility of hallucinations. That fits it. And then meth intoxication would be more bipolar 1 with or without psychotic features. And here you've got more anxiety, the nausea. It doesn't really fit the meth or the stimulant intoxication profile, which again would be more mania with or without psychotic features. Yes. Say that again. For stimulants, for sure, dilated eyes. For you could have dilated pupils with withdrawal from sedatives. Did I say something differently earlier? Okay. All right. I will. You could. It's not. You don't have to see it, but it could for sure. It could, in withdrawal, have dilation with the sedatives. Okay. And one more. Hopefully with this question you recognize what's your theme. This is someone who looks like they're manic with psychotic features. It's likely a stimulant. You've got two stimulants listed, which is the one that 6 hours later you'd still be likely high on. Meth. Yes, meth. Cocaine, you would have already lost your high by then because of the duration effects. Okay, excellent. Thank you. See you tomorrow for IMCQs.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.